You know, we all live in this world. But the question is, how do we understand the world that we live in? How do we understand the things that happen to us? How do we understand the things that are around us? Well, you know, it really all boils down to one thing, and that is interpretation. And that's a lot more involved and a lot more complicated than most of us realize. And it has some implications that I really want to explore as we do this show. So come on in and join me. The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. You know, I'm a big fan of foreign writers. I love Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Szymborska, Yukio Mishima, and so forth. However, since I don't read Russian or Polish or Japanese, I have to read these authors through translations. And I'm sure we've all heard or read translations in one form or another. You know, I've often said I like reading translated good poetry because I get to see, read the same good poets. I get at the same time to read two good poets. You have the original poet's works, and then you have the works of the one that's being translated. And if they both are good, you really get a delight. You get a double whammy, if you will. Now, in the end, of course, all translations are what? When you read something that's translated, what are you really reading? Well, you are reading an interpretation. That is, even more specifically, you are really reading just an interpretation of what is being written. The one translating is only interpreting what is being written. In most cases, translations are not directly word for word either. I mean, if you've ever studied foreign languages, you know how incredibly bad things might sound that are translated exactly word for word in the order of the original. I mean, at times it's almost incomprehensible. Plus, too, some languages have words that are not translatable. You know, that's one of the great mysteries of language, that not only words are different, but that syntax and word order are as well. Take, for example, the place that you live in. Okay? The place, English word for it is house. The Hebrew word for it is bayit. And if you took 10 other languages, you would have 10 other words, each sounding radically different from others. And depending on the language, they would be written in radically different characters, even though they all mean basically the same thing. But that's hardly the only difference in languages, as you know. Word order, syntax, grammar. My goodness, there's a whole host of very, very different forms and functions that take place between languages. And though decades ago there was this big rage from the work of linguist Noam Chomsky, who argued that despite the surface differences, there was this deep universal grammar to them all. And I think that idea has been pretty much debunked. The bottom line is that human languages vary greatly from each other in many, many ways. Thus, when you translate from one language to another, and I'm not talking so much languages that are close cousins, such as, Spanish to Portuguese, though only a little perhaps, but about radically different languages, which are really most of them, you are engaged in interpretation. You have to change not just the words for the other language, but the syntax and order and grammar and so forth. I mean, but even if you could do a literal translation, that is, even if you could put the words in some kind of exact order of the original, kind of a one-to-one isomorphic correspondence, you still have to pick and choose which words in the one language to use. In other words, you might have a couple of words in the second language to choose from, and the translator has to decide which one to use. And I suppose to some degree that's fairly arbitrary too. I mean, if you have a dictionary, say you have a Japanese to Arabic dictionary, okay, that's fine. You've got a dictionary in front of you. I've talked about this before. Well, where did the dictionary come from? But from, you know, where did the dictionary come from? But it came from, you know, people. People somewhat arbitrarily saying this word means that and so forth. But where did they, the writers of the dictionaries, where did they get their words from? Why did they choose the words they did and not other ones? I mean, is, you know, is there some sort of, you know, Platonic realm where these words exist in the absolute perfection of meanings, and the authors of dictionaries, you know, simply copy from this Platonic realm? I don't think so. It's, folks, much more arbitrary than that, much more. Anyway, the point of all this is that all translation from one language to another is really at the core interpretation. And of course, interpretations are just that, interpretations, which by their very nature are subjective. I just want to give you a few examples just to make my point. You know, I mentioned before Tolstoy. Well, here are a few lines from the opening page of his famous novel, War and Peace. You've probably all seen it. I don't know how many of you read it. It's a great read if you want to read a book that, you know, you practically need a cart to carry it around on. I don't know why these Russians write all these long books. Anyway, here's the opening line of War and Peace. It was July 1805, and the speaker was the well-known Anna Pavlovna Scherer, maid of honor and favorite of the Empress Maria Fedora. With these words, she greeted Prince Vasily Kurágin, a man of high rank and importance, who was first to arrive at her reception. Anna Pavlovna had a cough for some days. She was, as she said, suffering from la grippe. Grip being the new word in St. Petersburg, used only by the elite. Okay, those were the opening lines of War and Peace. Or were these the opening lines of War and Peace? With these words, the renowned Empress Anna of Pavlovna Scherer, lady-in-waiting and confidant of the Empress Maria Fedora, greeted Prince Vasily, a man of high rank and office, who was the first to arrive at her soiree on a July evening in the year 1805. Anna Pavlovna had been coughing for several days after having had the grip, grip being a new word used only by the elite. Now, did you notice a couple of things here? It probably could be easier if you were to see this in print, but there were a number of differences, not just in the words chosen, but in the word order, in the syntax, even though these words were taken from the same original Russian words. I mean, just one example. The first one started out by giving the date. It was July 1805. The second one didn't get that information until the end of the first line, okay? One started with it in the line and one ended with that with it with the line. Why the difference? It's, again, because every translation is an interpretation. Now, here's something from an ancient text from a city known as Ugarit, near ancient Israel. This is thousands of years old. It's taken from a text known as Keret. Okay, listen to this. This is a translation now. The clan died out. The house of the king was destroyed. There were seven brothers, eight sons of a mother. Keret, his children wiped out. Keret is devoid of an estate. He had taken a wife, his destined bride. He took a wife, but she departed. Progeny by a mother had been his. Now, here's the same text being read, being translated, or I should say, being interpreted by another ancient Northwest Semitic scholar. Ruined was the house of the king, who once had seven brothers, eight sons of one mother. Kurta, our patriarch, was destroyed. Kurta's dynasty was finished. His legal spouse went away. The woman he married left him. He had descendants. Now, These were the same Ugaritic words. And you can see the same words, but can you see the translations? Some radically different ideas. There were changes in how it was interpreted. And that's because, as I said, all translations are interpretations. Now, have any of you ever read James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake? Have you ever read that? If you've read that, you probably know where I'm going. I mean, this guy created his own version of the English language. Let me read you a little from Finnegan's Wake. The fall, Baba Baba Glara Karamaro Bronto Ronum Tomo Tomo Taro Hosamaka Horaduna Thunk of Once a Wall Street Old Part is retailed early in bed and later on down through all Christian ministry. Okay? Now all those words, that funny sounds, that was all one word. Can you imagine translating that? How do you translate that? Well, you don't really translate it. What you do is you interpret it. And I do know that this book has been, quote, translated into a number of foreign languages. Can you imagine that? Translated into a foreign language? Anyway, there's no sense belaboring the point. I guess we all would know that. You know, I don't want to make it trivial, belaboring the trivial. But the point is, all translations are interpretations. I would, however, like to take this another step and suggest something that you might have not thought about. I am saying that whenever you read or listen to something, even in your own language, when it's in your own language, you are doing the same thing. The same thing that when you translate from one language to another, and that is, you are interpreting. I mean, suppose I quote you from something. I'm going to quote you something in Hebrew. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz. Okay, you're hearing sounds, but unless you know Hebrew, you don't know what those sounds are. They're just noises. Two people can hear the same words, and one who knows Hebrew will interpret those words a certain way, and to someone else, they'll be just noises. Or if I read these words to you, you know, in English, the same principle would apply, okay? I'm going to read these to you in English. I want you to see my point here. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay? We say it again. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, you've all heard the same words, haven't you? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And you're hearing the same thing. I mean, the same molecules of air are reaching your eardrums, or vibrating molecules of air are reaching your eardrums. You're all hearing the same thing. Somewhat. Some of your hearing might not be as good as others. Beyond your eardrums, what happens? That's when things really start to get interesting. Now, if you happen to believe that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, then you're going to interpret what I said somewhat differently from someone who thinks the Bible story is a myth, right? You're going to be hearing the same things that come from my mouth in your native language, if you happen to be a native English speaker, but you still have to interpret what I'm saying. And each person is going to bring their own thoughts, their own experiences, their own subconscious to it. And when they're done, folks, they're all going to have their own spin on it. Let's take another example. Now, I happen to have, or I had, she just died. Don't get me on that, I'll start sobbing. But I had a pet, okay, a pet. And she was a German Shepherd. Now, when I say the word German Shepherd, okay, I had a German Shepherd named Penny, and I was very fond of her. But when I hear the word German Shepherd, I generally interpret in a way that makes me think of my dog who died, Penny. Now, suppose, though, you never had the honor of knowing my dog, Penny. Suppose instead that you were a prisoner in a camp and they used German shepherds as guard dogs. And suppose those mangy mutts bit you, attacked you, or attacked someone else that you knew. Suppose, though, then when you heard the phrase German shepherd, the first thing that came to your mind wasn't my little mutt Penny. It was one of those dogs that attacked you in the camp. So you hear the same words in English, the same sounds, the very same everything. But from the second they hit your eardrum, your mind does something with it quite differently than what my mind is going to do with it. And that is, your mind, it has to interpret it. You have to interpret that phrase as you do all the words, even in your native language. And you're going to do it differently than someone else. See, the point is, words are not absolute. They are symbols of things other than themselves, unless you're specifically talking about words themselves. Okay, if I talk about the word dog, and I am talking about a word, D-O-G, period, that's fine. But even when I have to talk about I still have to talk about it with other words, other symbols. In most conversations, though, we're not specifically talking about words themselves any more than when we talk about a carton of milk, we're talking about the cardboard box that the milk comes in. We are usually referring to what it contains. So the point is, when in conversation we use the word dog, we are talking about something other than the word dog itself, right? We are talking about what it symbolizes, and what it symbolizes is greatly different than what it is. I mean, my 75-pound dog is something quite different from the three little simple letters, D-O-G, that appeared upon my computer screen as I wrote this talk. And my dog is very different from the one-syllable sound dog that my mouth just made. And the word itself, dog, is very different from the universal concept dog, as in creatures of the canine species. Now, this all might be obvious, but the implications are interesting. And that implication is that because the word dog is a symbol of something other than itself, because it's a symbol, thus you have to do what with the symbol? Well, what does someone do with a symbol? Of course, you have to interpret it. And all words, all language, even if you're hearing and reading them in your own native language, has to be interpreted. Words in and of themselves are meaningless apart from those who interpret them. Wittgenstein dealt with this in his later languages. Think about this for a minute in his later writings. Think about this for a minute. Suppose there were no consciousness in the universe at all. No God, nothing. Just inanimate matter. Now let's get very hypothetical here. I've talked about this before, this whole idea of other universes being out there and proposed such thing. I think it's science fiction, but that's another matter. Now, suppose someone from one of these parallel universes came here and slipped and was able to pop into our universe, a universe with no conscious life at all, and leave a note in it. Kind of like what we did. Remember we did with that spacecraft years ago? We sent some spacecraft out into space with some goofy picture on it. And, you know, it was ridiculous. You know, I thought the whole thing was idiotic waste of money. But anyway, suppose that being left a note in this universe came from a parallel universe which said, all men desire to know. That's a line from Aristotle. And then that being disappeared back into the parallel universe with no contact again whatsoever with our universe. In fact, let's say the parallel universe that he went back to collapsed on itself and vanished into nothingness, so that no consciousness existed in any universe at all. None. There was no consciousness. But there is this note. There is this note. All men desire to know. Could it mean anything? What would it be? I mean, it would mean nothing at all, right? How could it mean anything at all if there were no consciousness there to read it and interpret it? In such a universe, what does even the concept meaning have? What does even concept mean? These words are useless, empty meaninglessness unless there is a conscious entity that can entertain a concept or that can give these things meaning. In other words, for words to have any meaning at all, there has to be a conscious entity there to read them, to hear them, and take them in and interpret them. So my point is simple. Even words in your own language, in and of themselves, are meaningless until someone comes in and interprets them. And then ultimately to interpret something is to put your own spin on it. So in the end, all language, even when people speak a common language each other, they are still doing what we do when we hear and we read and we speak in a foreign language. And that is interpret them. And interpretation by nature is subjective. But you know, there's more. This concept of interpretation goes even deeper. In fact, I would even say you don't even need to deal with other people. No, we have to really interpret our own mind, our own thoughts, our own feelings. Now, what does that mean? Well, think about it for a minute. Think about it for a minute. Just as the word dog, D-O-G, is not a dog or any dog or even the whole species of dogs. When you write down your thoughts, you're not really writing down your thoughts. You're writing down words, words that are an interpretation of your own thoughts, right? I mean, you can never write down a thought or a feeling or even an idea. You write down or you speak words, and words, whether written or spoken, are just that, words, symbols, symbols of your own ideas and thoughts. I mean, what does a thought look like on paper? What color is a thought? What color is a mood? A thought is in your brain, in your mind. It's not on paper. You know, it's not something that you can pull out of the air as you do words. Ideas, thoughts, and feelings are not words. Words, even if you think them in your head, are expressions, symbols, interpretations of whatever you are thinking. I mean, who has never been in the position of saying, I know what I mean, but I just can't find the words? And when you do find the words to express your emotions, your feelings, your ideas, what are they but symbols, interpretations of those inner rumblings in your head? That's all they are, interpretations of what's going on inside you. I mean, they're not exact representations, are they? How could they be? It's something that only you in your interior are experiencing. And then, limited by your vocabulary, by your own language, by your own facility with words, you try to express them. Thus, when someone's in the act of writing a book or a poem or anything, they are simply interpreting what is going on inside themselves, translating their ideas, their feelings, and their moods into words, which are symbols and nothing more. I mean, let me take a few lines from one of my favorite poets, Ruth Stone. Listen to this. This is one of my favorite poets. Listen to her. This is the end of March. The tax collector wants me to cut my wrists. The roach inspector drives up in a truck. The snow sits like dough turning sour. Every hour's love's bones grow lighter. This is what comes of having no pity. Time use me. I live in Johnson City. Now, of course, we hear these words and we interpret them. They enter into our minds through our ears, and then our mind, based on a host of subjective factors, we will interpret this poem in our own way. But even before that interpretation, you have Ruth Stone doing interpreting, which is obviously her own despair. The poem is called "The Professor Cries." Ruth Stone was a professor. The professor was having a bad day, was having thoughts and feelings and emotions that clearly were not that great. And this is how she interpreted those emotions with that poem. Okay? This is the end of March. The tax collector wants me to cut my wrists. The roach inspector dries up in a truck. The snow sits like dough turning sour, and on and on and on she goes. Okay, that poem is not her bad mood. It's not her pessimism. It's an interpretation of her bad mood, her pessimism. Now, my point in all this is that everything really in life all boils down to interpretation, to hermeneutics, if you will. Everything we see, everything we say, everything we read, everything we write, everything we create, everything we do is interpretation. And so the question is that I want to ask as we start to wind this down, we're interpreting things. It's all we do. But I guess the question is, how do we know we are interpreting things correctly? That's a very loaded question, and it comes with a lot of presuppositions. The biggest one being, what makes us think that there is a correct interpretation to begin with? I mean, if an author has to interpret his own thoughts and feelings in order to create a text, and then we have to interpret the text, we are simply interpreting the author's own interpretation. We might have a totally different spin than what the author himself meant. In fact, it's kind of passé now, but there was a whole field of literary criticism in which they said you got to interpret the text apart from the author. It doesn't matter what the author said, you interpret it. And, you know, the argument is that it makes no difference what the interpreter was intending. Meaning is fluid, dynamic, contingent upon what the reader brings to it. Now, there's some truth to this. And there's some truth to this whole idea that we interpret everything about us. But I guess the question comes down to, there is a lot of subjectivity with everything that we do. But how far do you take that? You know, as I've been saying, once you understand that subjectivity is part of life, that's fine. That's the first step and a very important one. But I guess, in other words, I guess the question I'm asking you is, have you ever thought about how your own interpretation of the world, how accurate that is? Or maybe you're interpreting everything wrong. Maybe how you understand the world, maybe you view the world, reality, your existence, maybe it's grandly skewed, maybe even grandly distorted, maybe even giving you a completely false interpretation of what's really out there. Hey, there's something's out there. There's no doubt there's a reality here, folks. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, some try to argue that there really isn't and so on. I'm not going to get into that. Oh, there are actually some pretty good arguments on that, but I'm not going to go there. But the question I want to leave you this is, you're still interpreting things. You're interpreting your life. You're interpreting everything that's going on around you, whether you realize it or not. But you know, there's a lot of subjectivity in the very concept of interpretation. So I ask you, are you getting reality right, or are you interpreting it all wrong? Because in the end, there's no question, you are interpreting.